have a whole party.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is April 29th. I'm going to open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 232 and call Representative Parrish, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 232 comes to us from the Department of Corrections. This comes to us with an indeterminate fiscal and no revenue impact. It authorizes the Department of Corrections to apply for grants or other financial support for reentry services. It establishes the Department of Corrections subaccount for funding received and continuously appropriates funding in the subaccount for reentry support and services. The bill declares an emergency and is effective on passage and came out of the Senate Judiciary with a 5-0 unanimous vote.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 233. Just had another bill, or 232, 32. Sorry. 233 was just in health care, a different bill around the health care issue around people coming back in reentry. So it just came from that earlier. But coming here today to testify on Senate Bill 232, you know, of course, we just had a robust debate about the ban the box issue. One of the biggest pieces, whether we do that or not, is the ability for the Department of Corrections and the nonprofit world and everybody who is trying to do the work of reentry to have the dollars they need. Senate Bill 232 would allow the Department of Corrections to go out and accept grants, and whether it's from the federal government, from some other nonprofit, but to be able to have some dollars to do this work. The reentry piece, I think, is the most important part of somebody coming back in and trying to get their life back on track, whether that's health care, housing, whether it's job retraining, a scholarship program. It could be any number of things that move the dial. And actually, it's interesting because when you look at line 20 of the bill, reentry support and services includes but not limited to housing, employment, vocational assistance, transportation, treatment, access, mental health, medications, mentoring. That really sounds like a lottery bill for veterans that I know of. A lot of similar issues coming out of an institutionalized setting, whether it's the military or out of corrections, and trying to reintegrate back into civilian life. And so when I see a bill like this, I think it's really critical that this is a permission bill, that we give permission so that we can get the funds that I think is really needed in our communities to do this work, and particularly on the community correction side and working with the Department of Corrections. So I just appreciate your work in this committee and hope that you would support this bill, and I'll take any questions if you have them.
Questions for Representative? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you,
Representative. You get out of here to your next meeting.
Yep, thanks.
You bet. Jeremiah Stromberg and Marge Easley, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeremiah Stromberg. I'm the Assistant Director of the Community Corrections Division for the Department of Corrections. I can't say it any better than Representative Parrish just did. She certainly outlined for you the significance of this bill that allows us to truly collaborate with the counties and provide additional reentry services. Currently, the large counties have the infrastructure and capability to compete for some of these large-scale grants, which total in the millions each year, but our smaller jurisdictions do not. And with the Department of Corrections, with our infrastructure, our ability to competitively compete for many of these grants, we'll be able to work more collaboratively with many of our counties that currently we haven't been able to on this scale. And so with that, I'm certainly happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? Please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Marge Easley, and I'm here on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Clackamas County. We strongly support SB 232, and I'm here today not on behalf of the League, but on behalf of a group of women at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility that I've had the privilege to work with for the past 2 years. I've been involved with a class there in which it's called a computer tech class, but it's actually a life skills class that helps prepare them for reentry upon release. And we discussed the important. I was asked to come in and talk about civic engagement opportunities, the importance of voting, workings of our governmental system, ways to advocate for themselves in a society that places a stigma on those with felony convictions. So as part of the lesson on the legislative process, we brought to the class's attention three bills from this session that would expand educational and reentry opportunities for inmates. And this particular bill, SB 232, was one of them. The other two were had been introduced by Representative Parrish, who was just here, HB 3119 and HB 3120. The women studied these bills very, very thoroughly and with great interest. They then wrote heartfelt testimony that tied these bills to their individual experiences and hopes for the future. They were thrilled when Representative Parrish agreed to come to Coffee Creek and listen to their prepared testimony. It was a truly moving day to see them witness the excitement, or to see that legislators were working on their behalf and cared about what happened to them when they were released. These women can't be here today, of course, so I'd like to just share a few quotes from what they wrote regarding the need for increased funding for reentry support and services. One inmate said, "When I was released the first time, I was forced to go back to a county where there was little family support and funding, and because of this, I am a recidivism statistic." Another, "I am from a small rural community. There's little public transportation in some areas, none in others, so getting to a job is extremely difficult." Another, "I have problems with my depression and need to stay on medication, which the county was paying for until they lost their funding. Because of the cost of the medication, I chose to self-medicate, which brought me to relapse. And lastly, "I live on a reservation, and every state treatment facility is 45 miles away. I have to go to a treatment at a state-certified facility to get my children back, but I'm not eligible for treatment here at Coffee Creek. In order to get the treatment I need when I'm released, I cannot parole to my home because there are no resources where I live, and I'd need help with transportation and housing. So on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Clackamas County and the women of Coffee Creek, I thank you for this hearing today and urge passage of 232. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
We are.
Okay, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 232 and open a work session on Senate Bill 232.
Question,
please.
Well, not really a question.
Well, discussion.
But, you know, in our public safety, we had corrections, parole and probation, OSP, Department of Justice, Youth Authority, and another budget or two. Every one of those budgets, the question has come up under 3194 and the importance of services to reduce recidivism, provide these people an opportunity to get out. It was talked about on the floor today with our controversial little bill. But it seems everybody's aware of it. Everybody values it. Everybody wants it to happen. And then when we did 3194, I mean, everybody was glued to what the guy from Clackamas County was talking about. The mentor program, have someone come in, get them a job lined up, get them a driver's license, get them a Social Security card, give them a place to live. Meet with them weekly. That's how you reduce it. And that investment is going to pay dividends not only in dollars and cents, but it's going to get people back into the communities and families established. And I think that has huge value that you can't measure in dollars.
And reduction of future victims, which
yep.
is vital.
Okay.
We're in work session.
Has Representative yes. Greenleck notice any drafting errors?
Move the bill. Hurry up, so hurry up and get it out.
All right, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 188 to the floor.
Oh, no, 232.
232. Oh, shoot, I was reading wrong. I was ahead of myself. 232 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
President Williamson moves Senate Bill 232 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Yeah, Julie Parrish.
Okay, Representative Parrish, carrier, please. Who's going to yield time on the floor?
You know what?
Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 188.
Microphones are on.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 188A was requested by the Office of the Attorney General. The bill creates the crime of the unlawful dissemination of an intimate image. It prohibits the non-consensual disclosure of an intimate picture to a website with a specific intent to harass, humiliate, or injure another person. The first violation is a Class A misdemeanor, and each subsequent violation would be a Class C felony. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. Aaron Knott and Christina Gordon. We could have all four come up if you want to pull up another chair, April Custers and Kelsey Wilson.
Also, I guess I'm sorry. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I am the legislative director for the Oregon Attorney General here in support of Senate Bill 188. So back in 2014, a draft was circulated to deal with what's colloquially called revenge porn, which is and it's not a good name, which is why we're not calling it that in the bill. But there are images that are taken usually consensually, usually within romantic relationship, and then uploaded to a website or social media after the termination of that relationship, or sometimes even within the confines of that relationship. And a draft was circulating in the short session. I don't know if it ever even made it to the bill. And former legislative director of the ACLU, Becky Strauss, and I actually basically slammed into each other running in to explain why it was totally unconstitutional. And that started a long and pretty tricky six-month conversation between DOJ, OCDLA, the ACLU Legislative Council, ODAA, to try and figure out how to tackle this problem constitutionally. And I am confident that Senate Bill 188 is that answer. So again, a little bit about the problem this is trying to solve. This is one of those things that no one had seen 10 years ago, where with the explosion of not just internet activity, but cam phones, you know, cameras on phones, we've started seeing these pictures being taken. They're intimate images. They depict nudity or sexual activity. And again, they're taken consensually. And then after the relationship ends, they start turning up on the internet. And sometimes this is obvious things like Facebook, which is very, very damaging by itself. I mean, your employer, your friends, your parents, your family, they all have Facebook. I mean, they all have Facebook. But there are also websites that are specifically dedicated to dealing with revenge pornography and hosting revenge pornography, which have names like myex.com. And when you upload there, it's often done with the full name of the person depicted, the address of the person depicted, the email address of the person depicted. And because of the way those websites structure themselves, if you're ever Googled, that's what comes up. And it comes up forever. Somebody punches in your name, those intimate images will be right on the first page, and there's pretty much no way to take them down. And that's because any attempt to do anything by the legislature falls within two sideboards. On one side, federal law, the other one, our state constitution. I need to touch a little bit on both. First of all, I get asked all the time, if these websites exist, why do we simply not take them down? And that's because of Section 32, the Federal Communications Decency Act, which prohibits state legislators like ours from making any regulation of the content of a website. And for now, any conversation to change that will have to happen federally. But our constitutional protections for freedom of speech are among the most robust, if not the most robust in the country. So this is what it takes to get through. It isn't accurate to say you can't regulate speech at all, of course, but you have to do so very, very carefully. And in Oregon, the test that you have to follow is that you don't focus on the speech or even the content of the speech. You focus on the harm. And the test is, we all call it the Robertson test, which is the case that really sort of lays it out. So if a person uploads an intimate image, they have to intend harm by doing it, humiliation or harassment. That harm has to actually occur, and that harm has to be reasonable. And what that ends up meaning as applied to something like this is, if you're trying to humiliate somebody by plastering pictures of them all over the internet, if your goal is to ruin their lives, to haunt them forever, then this bill covers it. But there are a whole host of other purposes that would not be covered. If you had a political justification, a scientific justification, and this is the one that I will say gives me the most heartburn, but I want you all to know to be clear on how this part works. If you don't have the intent to humiliate or harass, it's not covered. And that means cases where a person, say, two people that don't know each other very well, get together and decide to take some pictures, and then the next day they pop up on an internet site, and the person who uploaded them says, listen, I don't even know their name. I didn't do this to humiliate them. I did this to impress my friends. Well, if you couldn't find some evidence that it was done with the specific intent to humiliate or harass, it wouldn't count. And that's out of deference to our Constitution, and that's why I think this is a constitutional product, and I want to emphasize again, it was a long road to get it there. OCDLA, I believe, is neutral. The ACLU is neutral, and I think that sends a strong message. So this is a real problem, a spreading problem. We'll be the 17th state to put something like this on the books, and I am open for any questions.
Hello, thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Christina Gordon, and I am a victim of the theft of an intimate image and the sharing of that image without my consent. Senate Bill 188 is intended to make the dissemination of an intimate image without the person's consent an unlawful act, like Aaron was saying, with the intent to harm or harass or injure someone. My story doesn't fall into the qualifications of this bill, but it still prompted me to try and take action to get this on the books in Oregon, because I think it's a very important bill that we need to address. On August of 2013, I arrived to my shift at work. It was a normal Friday night, except for at the beginning of the shift, I found out that one of our managers had been fired. I didn't think too much of it. I went along with my shift. In the middle of my shift, my regional manager asked me to come into the office. I went in. He asked me to close the door, and he began to tell me why the manager was fired. At first, I didn't understand why it was any of my business and just kind of let him go forward with it. And then it became clear why I was in that office. The manager that was fired would often fix the laptops or cell phones of employees of that place of business. And he had fixed an employee's laptop. When the employee got that laptop back, there was a new file on it. When he clicked on that file, he found a grotesque folder of nearly hundreds of intimate images of female employees, past and present, and I found out that I was one of them. I had never shared an intimate photo, especially with him. It was a private photo, intimate, like I said, and it was humiliating. I found that not only had he shared that on another employee's computer, but that wasn't anything new, that he had shared that with text messages, emails with other male employees. So I went to the police department to try and file some sort of report, because obviously it felt like a crime was committed, but the police department could not do anything for me. Even though they wanted to, there was absolutely nothing on the books that they could do. So it basically was a case closed. Move on. So then I contacted Michelle Roland Schwartz with the State Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force, started having this conversation with her. She provided her testimony that you can take a look at later. She then got me into contact and started having the conversations with Aaron Knott, and this whole process got started. So it's been a really long 2 years. Since the 2 years, the damage that it has occurred has affected me in every single area of my life. It was humiliating. I ended up leaving that place of business 3 weeks later because I didn't feel comfortable there anymore. My privacy was stolen from me, and hundreds, if not thousands, of women in Oregon are dealing with this problem, and they don't have any options to turn to. And you're never quite the same when your privacy has been violated in this way. You begin to think about all of the people that saw your private and intimate image, and you begin to feel like every set of eyes that looked upon your body takes little pieces of you every time. I'm fortunate not to have had my image shared on these what's known as revenge porn sites. I feel wholeheartedly for the women that are tormented and people. It's not just women. It's also some men, although it's more prevalent with women. They don't have any options, and I don't want to see them reduced to being trading cards or having their bodies exploited like that. Victims also feel like they blame themselves or feel that they're going to be shamed by people. I will say that when I started this whole process, I braced myself for the fact that maybe someone will say, well, you shouldn't have had that photo on your phone in the first place. You caused this to happen yourself. I was ready for that, but to my surprise, Oregon has been so supportive in every single step of the way. Senate Bill 188 passed the Senate Judiciary Committee with all votes in favor. Senator Gelser carried the bill onto the floor. It passed unanimously, in which both parties actually spoke in favor of it. One other thing that I do want to add, and then I'll finish up, is just as Aaron was saying, our technology is something that we're really trying to keep up with. The pace in which we're finding these dark places in the internet or technology in general, we have to do something to make sure that we're holding people accountable and that we're speaking for the victims and giving them options, because I did not get any justice whatsoever. My justice is fighting for the victims of this crime that should be a crime, should you make it so. So I please urge the same action of this committee that the Senate Judiciary Committee put forth, and that we can get this to the House floor and finally make it a bill. So thank you very much. Do you have any questions?
Thank you. We'll go ahead and
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is April Custers, and I am the Assistant Director at Portland State University Student Legal Services. I represent PSU students in their various legal problems, so I'm a generalist. Our office, unfortunately, over the past few years, see quite a number of revenge porn cases every single academic year. For instance, I have about 30 active cases right now, and 3 of them involve revenge porn, so that's quite a lot. So I have permission from 2 of my clients to not divulge their names, but at least to tell you some information about their stories. So one of my clients is now divorced, thankfully, from her husband. During their marriage, they took a video of them having sex. In their relationship, if domestic violence was present, she finally found the courage to leave him. And his next step, the very next day, was to put images from the video onto Craigslist, along with identifying information about her. Her phone number, hey, give her a call for a good time, along with a naked picture. He also uploaded the full video onto his blog. Just to name a couple of the incidences. The frustrating part for me is there's very little that she could do. She, to address this issue specifically, she's also a student teacher, so her main concern is that the parents of the kids that she's teaching, that if one were to Google her, that it is quite easy to find this video. It's an ongoing issue, and there's, like I said, very little that I could do, and this bill would specifically help out a person in her situation. Another case, during the course of my client's relationship with her ex-boyfriend, he took a couple of images, pictures from his phone. Again, domestic violence present. She eventually left him, and although they have been separated for 2 whole years, he makes new Facebook accounts, finds her, and then sends every single one of her friends a message that includes the image that he took of her. He's continued to do this over the past 2 years. It doesn't matter if she tries to figure out a new way to find, you know, a new made-up Facebook name. She's gotten to the point where she, if she has new contacts, she warns them that this is coming. That is what her life has come to. So that's what I see a lot of, unfortunately, and this bill would go a long way to help out PSU students and other victims of revenge porn. And I'll take any questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. Kelsey Wilson representing Facebook. I'd like to start by thanking the Attorney General and Aaron for their work and leadership on this measure to go after the individual perpetrators of revenge porn. Our mission at Facebook is to give people the power to share and make the world more open and connected, but there are just some things that shouldn't be shared openly. At Facebook, we go to great lengths to ensure pornographic images are not posted on our site, and we work closely with law enforcement to go after these perpetrators. We have dedicated teams working around the world to review abusive behavior on Facebook and make sure it remains a safe online community. Having a law in the books outlawing such harassing behavior gives us more ammunition to go after these bad actors. Anti-revenge porn laws are making a difference across the country, and we encourage Oregon to join these other states by passing Senate Bill 188A. Thank you for the opportunity, and happy to answer any questions.
I have a question maybe to you. So I read when I was in Hawaii, I read an account over there where somebody took their computer into a repair shop, and it doesn't matter the name of that, but whoever was working on it then downloaded, these people had intimate photographs on there, downloaded that and then put them up on the web. So would this cover somebody doing that?
Chair Barker, I am very glad you asked that question. The answer is no, this bill won't, but this question was raised on the Senate side, and it was raised early enough that we were able to find a vehicle that specifically addresses that question. I think it's also coming to this committee, if I remember correctly, it's Senate Bill 377.
Correct.
Okay, so it is on the way.
Okay, good. Because that seemed to be a whole... Yes,
Representative. No, Mr. Chairman, I was darn close to the question I was going to ask, but just wanted to maybe... ask Aaron, and then I'm sorry, in the black.
April,
thank you. So Aaron, the one thing from one of the stories that April told about the, unfortunately, you're going to love this. I'm a Facebook fanatic, she knows that, and have a gazillion likes and followers and all that stuff. So I'm pretty active on that. And I get a lot of, I've received those kinds, what you described myself in my direct message, which is why I chose to turn mine off, by the way. Sorry, I just don't use it, because I got so many of those. Who in this bill, in that situation, who gets in trouble, I guess is what I'm trying to, who, because it was this guy sent of this person, and it was to a fake account, and it, you know what I'm saying? Who gets in trouble here?
Chair right Barker, Representative Post. That's an answerable question. So, again, going back to that notion that you have to, well, this requires you both to upload and to have the intent to humiliate or harass. And I think that gives you two different ways for not being the person that would be the problem. If you continued to disseminate the image and you had an independent intent to humiliate or harass that person, you know, if you forwarded it to all your friends with that intent, I think you would become eligible for the crime. Furthermore, I think you should become eligible for the crime. But if you just come into possession of it, you know, you don't know this person, you bear them no ill will, and you don't disseminate the image, there are several reasons why this wouldn't apply to you.
Okay, I can follow up. I wasn't thinking so much in that. I was thinking, okay, not that I was... I'm not going to forward it. So what I'm getting at is, who does this get for sending me that image? And second of all, maybe a Facebook follow-up to that would be, I would just comment that Facebook is really good about, I report those every time I get them. Boom, hit the report button, and obviously they go away, and I'm sure you guys are going after them. Who do we go after with this bill? Who gets in trouble? I guess would be back to the original question.
Chair Barker, Representative Post, the person who would be eligible for prosecution under this crime would be a person who knowingly causes to be uploaded or disseminated, first of all, on the website with the intent to humiliate or harass that person. So in this case, if the person who forwarded it to you, it would depend a bit on their circumstances, what they meant to do when they forwarded it to you. But if their intent was, say, to just blast out this image of a person who they knew and wanted to harm to every elected official in the state as a way of raising the profile, that would be very stupid, but that would qualify for this offense. So that's what it takes. And again, that's narrow. I mean, you both have to be the uploader, and you have to have that very specific criminal intent.
Okay, so the guy, in this case then, the ex-husband, boyfriend?
The ex-boyfriend.
We'd be able to go after him.
Chair Barker, Representative Post, that is absolutely who this bill targets.
All right, then secondary to that, because again, sorry to pick on Facebook, but I get the same sorts of things that I think they're more spammy. You know, they're Alice says, hey, be my friend, and it's pretty provocative stuff. Would this cover that sort of thing? Because now that wasn't revenge. That was, maybe I'm going too far, but this was, that's more spammish.
Well, and Chair Barker, Representative Post, I think a lot of those pictures, there are exceptions in the bill for conventional intimate images that were taken consensually for a commercial purpose or with the consent of the person being depicted for something like that. So if it's going to turn again on how the person who was photographed, their relationship to who took it, and then whether there's that intent to harm. If you're receiving those images in an attempt to get you to click on something and nothing else, and they're not being sent with this humiliating intent, then no, that would not be covered.
Yeah, I do. Thanks, okay. Mr. Chair. Okay. So, Aaron, I heard what Christina shared about, and her comment that I heard that caught my attention was, you're never really the same when you've had your intimate photos displayed on the Internet. Okay. And I see this is graduated, so from A to C felony. Any thought when you were involved in the working with Gail and the others on this whole thing of maybe considering sex offender registration on this?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, that was discussed. We ultimately didn't go forward on that.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Anybody else? Representative Barton.
I just wanted to thank a soon-to-be crime victim, but the victim for coming forward. I really appreciate your testimony. It was heartfelt and moving. It takes a lot of courage to do what you're doing.
Chair Barker, Rep Barton, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. I appreciate you giving me the time to do this and your consideration.
Takes a lot of courage.
Yeah, thank you very much. Anything further? Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing. We're not going to move the bill today. When representatives from the cable company had a technical question he wanted to get clarified, and once that's clarified, I plan to move it right away.
Oh, and Chair Barker, there was some discussion of putting an emergency clause on the bill as well. I think that may also be pending, and of course, I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, so. I do too. Thank you. Okay. Open a public hearing, possible work session on Senate Bill 366.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 366 comes to this committee at the request of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. The bill modifies the definition of recidivism for purposes of statistical analysis by state agencies and public bodies. Currently, a person recidivates if, within 3 years of conviction or release from custody, they are again arrested, convicted, or incarcerated for any reason. This bill requires that the subsequent arrest, conviction, or incarceration specifically be for a new crime. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Mike. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. This bill really comes to, it's requested by the Criminal Justice Commission, but it really comes from the Public Safety Task Force on House Bill 3194. The definition of recidivism was changed in that bill in 2013, and after it was changed, there became a lot of concerns with some of the practitioners on what this definition would mean and how they do their business. So I'll give you an example. The way the definition is currently written, any incarceration for any reason, arrest for any reason, would count as recidivism. So if you are a person who's in a drug court, in a treatment court, and let's say that you miss an appointment with your PO, right? So your PO says, okay, well, you know, I've talked to you about this before, and so you're going to have to do an overnight in jail. Well, then that person would, under this definition, have just recidivated. So when we talked to the drug court professionals who do this, they said, well, the way our treatment courts work, we're essentially going to have 100% recidivism in our programs. So the same concerns for community corrections directors, anybody working with offenders that said, you know, this definition, the sub B part of the definition, that doesn't require a new crime, but just says for any reason, if you are incarcerated, convicted, or arrested, that's recidivism, is just not actually very useful information. Because it's just going to happen at such a frequency that it's almost meaningless. So that's what this bill intends to fix. It would take away that sub B and leave behind only the three measures of recidivism for a new crime. So if you're arrested for a new crime, if you're convicted of a new crime, if you're incarcerated on a new crime, that would remain recidivism. This bill just says the for any reason part would be removed. It's a consensus bill. Like I said, Public Safety Task Force worked on this in the subcommittees. You have community corrections directors, DAs, defense attorneys. They're all a part of that task force. And so it's been in consensus and asked that you support it.
Okay. Any questions?
Yeah, I guess I'm just thank you. Any word on why the no's that we got over on the Senate side? Did anybody explain anything that you can remember maybe from?
Chair Barker, Representative Post. No one has reached out to me. Again, in the law enforcement groups that we've worked with, there hasn't been anybody that's expressed concern to the Criminal Justice Commission or the task force, so I'm not sure exactly what happened.
So, okay, there was just no – were you there for
– I wasn't.
Okay, yeah. No problem.
Okay. Anything further? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 366. Open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 366 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 366 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
I'll do it.
Representative Olson will be a carrier. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 387.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, Senate Bill 387A comes to us from the Interim Committee. It requires a court to ensure fingerprinting from a person arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants and establishes that the court will make inquiry concerning fingerprinting at the time of arraignment, sentencing, and diversion entry. It applies to offenses committed on or after the effective date of the act. So currently in practice, individuals who are booked into jail are fingerprinted under jail policy. However, there's no statutory requirement for such record keeping. And as such, individuals who are eligible for DUI diversion and not arrested at the scene are not fingerprinted for arrest. This creates problems with recidivism data collection. So the intent of this bill is just to keep a monitor on recidivism data for DUI arrests by ensuring that offenders are properly fingerprinted so that we can track them.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, I have nobody signed up to testify on that.
This was Judge Jones from Multnomah County was the proponent of this and worked pretty heavily on it. We do have some written testimony submitted.
I'll come on as well. Well, I also have a question. Does this include the identification of a case number as a part of that fingerprinting? That was something Judge Jones was concerned about.
Yeah, it includes an identification, a SID number.
Right.
So we worked really closely. In fact, we had an informational hearing on fingerprinting and data collection on the Senate side to make sure that this bill appropriately addressed the fingerprinting issue. And it's the SID number that needs to be generated in order to track these folks for recidivism data. So that was looked at and made sure that this applied to it.
Judge Jones brought me this idea, and what he was concerned with was the ability to look at statistics of the diversion compared to other things, and that the problem was that you couldn't identify all the cases, so there was this data going loose, and the purpose of this was essentially tighten up the data process so you could find out the extent to which the diversion programs were working or they weren't working.
Okay. Thank you.
So, you know, Mr. Chair, when you think about it, both you and Representative Krieger, you remember that in the past, you'd always, if you arrested somebody for driving under the influence, you always had them lodged, and at that point, then they'd be fingerprinted. But over the last several years, I mean, that's kind of slowly been drifted away from doing that because you just, you know, this is not one of those things that you lodge anybody over hardly anymore. This here would really actually create a good path for tracking.
Okay, yeah, it would. I mean, for years in court, we wouldn't lodge people if they were too bad, and they could have somebody come pick them up, so they never went through that process. Okay, I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 387.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 387 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 387 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Greenick, would you like to carry that back?
I'd be happy to.
Okay, thank you. open a public hearing on Senate Bill 600.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 600 comes from the Senate Judiciary Committee. Oregon law requires the Criminal Justice Commission to review legislation and adopt any necessary changes to the sentencing guidelines. This bill approves the adoption of and modification of rules by the Criminal Justice Commission. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Mr. Schmidt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. I gave to staff a kind of a cheat sheet for you so you can see exactly what rules were modified by the Criminal Justice Commission, what bills that were passed in 2013 required the modification of the rules, and then just a brief description on each of those rules, exactly what it is. For the most part, a lot of the legislation, as you all are aware, tells and directs the Criminal Justice Commission to rank something of a certain crime seriousness. There really isn't as much discretion for the Criminal Justice Commission as there used to be in ranking the bills. So a lot of it is just us carrying out what the legislature asks us to do, and the statute requires that we then come back to you once we've made those rules and ask that for your approval. So that's what this bill does. And I can ask or answer any questions.
Okay. Are there any questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 600. Open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 600 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Robinson moves Senate Bill 600 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Anybody like to carry this one? Leininger, sure. Please. Thank you. Representative Leininger will carry. Open a work session on Senate Bill 590.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 590, you heard yesterday, this was the court visitors for minors who are likely to be under a guardianship as an adult. Rep. Greenlick had a question yesterday, and we held off on the work session to get him a good answer. And the question was about Section 2, Subs 3A and 3B and how they interact. I would just like to clarify that subsection 3A on page 3 requires information on the control of the estate of the respondent, and it's part of the petition in all guardianship proceedings. Subsection 3B deals with the requirement to include a statement to the court about the necessity to appoint a court visitor, which is why we have the new language added there.
Mr. Chair, I thought you were waving.
No.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 590 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. You're making sudden moves.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 590 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Maybe Representative Krieger, would you like to carry this bill?
Yeah, I can do it.
Okay. Open a work session on Senate Bill 622A.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, you heard Senate Bill 622 yesterday on mandatory reporters. Representative Greenlick pointed out a new reporting requirement. We did some follow-up work on that. And yes, indeed, Representative Greenlick is correct that this bill specifically calls out legislators as mandatory reporters of abuse of residents in a long-term care facility or adults with developmental disabilities or mental illness. Currently, the statute requires public officials to report under those statutes, but not specifically legislative assembly members. This bill includes them within those particular provisions.
Any questions?
Well, it's just, I want to make the point that we want to make explicit when we're adding a requirement for legislators, and so it shouldn't pass under the, I don't think it's a bad idea.
Yeah, we appreciate your eagle eye on that one.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 622A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 600 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
622.
I'm sorry, right finger was covering the wrong thing. 622A. Thank you. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, 622A is passed. And do I have somebody who would like to carry that one? Representative Barton will be the carrier. Any further business to come before the committee?
You were pretty sneaky today getting all the bills moved before Representative Greenlick
got here. Show up.
Expedite.
Members,
I was prepared to keep my mouth shut today.
Yeah, no meeting on Thursday or Monday. No meeting on Thursday or Monday. The Senate is much slower than us in cranking up. We are adjourned.